We are about to start our third year of podcasting, and as we look back, there is one thing we cannot deny.
It's because of you, our listeners, our day ones, our international coalition. Indy, I see you.
You came to our live shows, listened to thousands of episodes, responded with likes and comments on our social media, and helped us make moves in an industry where everyone has a podcast.
We have released over 250 episodes, serving you some of our best analysis and interviewing some of the biggest names, along with those making an impact in the wrestling industry.
So we just want to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just wanted to say thank you, I guess.
Come on, Matt Michaels, be nice.
Go! Prepare yourself for another year of...
Welcome to another edition of Wrestling Talk.
This is the DeFalco Files with the one and only Joe DeFalco.
This is Three Count.
Hey everybody, it's Matt Michaels, and this is People I Don't Hate.
Prepare yourselves for another year of douchebaggery, hijinks, and some talking out of the ass from all of us at the Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting.
Vegas Bad Boys Podcast presents Matt Michaels, People I Don't Hate.
Hey everybody, Matt Michaels here, and I am joined by one of my favorite personalities in the wrestling industry over the last 30 years now, I guess. Although I'm not going to date you that much.
I think 30 years is a long time.
But in terms of people that I can compare you to and what I've seen over the last 30 years, you've been one of my favorite personalities in the wrestling business. Fans know him as Sign Guy Dudley or as Lou E. Dangerously. It's none other than Lou D'Angeli.
D'Angeli.
D'Angeli, damn it. I knew it.
D'Angeli, D'Angeli.
There we go.
I appreciate the compliment of being your favorite for 30 years, or one of your favorites for 30 years.
Well, over the 30-year nice period.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess what it comes down to is, there has been, I think, that kind of lost art form of what a manager or slash promoter hype man does in the business. And yeah, you hit it like right at the right time when I really, Paul Bearer might have been the only person in the last, three decades that you can think of that had as much of a presence that wasn't a female, It all went that way. How did you think about getting into wrestling? Was wrestling always part of your life?
Yeah, let me address the first piece. So I agree with you completely. I think the wrestling manager is a lost form completely.
Yeah.
So I don't want to let that go by, because I think that there's so many reasons to have one. And speaking is one of them. If you're a good talker and you can help someone get over more because they're maybe not a good talker, and you can work in tandem with each other. I think that's one of the biggest things. And then it's the old, I'm a big old school kind of guy. It's the old school throw powder in your face and handcuff you to the ring or the ring, ring ropes. And, so you can't get and help your guy. I mean, there's so many, pull the leg, distract the ref, pull the ref out of the ring. There's so many things that I think are lost. Because that's not a factor anymore.
Right.
And I think hopefully, maybe one day that comes back. I also said maybe it comes back like a couple of years ago. It's never come back. But, I think if you look in the 70s, 80s, 90s, between like Bobby Heenan and you said Paul Bearer, which I agree with, obviously Pauly Dangerously, and then Jimmy Hart. And there's so many guys that you go down the list. Slick, they're just kind of popping in my head right now. But you know. And then what was really cool about the male manager kind of role too was that, or just, I don't want to say male, because I just say in general a manager, because it can go either way, was also the fact that, you know, it gave a chance to guys who couldn't perform in the ring anymore to still be involved, you know. So you had like when Kurt Hennig was hurt and he was Ric Flair's guy, like things like that worked, I thought, really, really well, and gave guys a chance to keep performing.
Yeah.
And I think the women as well, you know, the women have evolved so much in wrestling. I'm going a little off topic right now, where, you know, what they were used for in the Attitude Era versus what they're doing now is like amazing. You know, I have an 11-year-old daughter who can't get enough of watching the women wrestling.
Yeah.
And I think it's amazing, you know, and she's inspired by that. And so that's evolved. And I'm hoping that managers come back as part of that evolution. So that was just a general statement.
But yeah. And as far as when you first saw wrestling, what do you remember, what it was, who it was, what drove you? Because I can tell you right off the bat that for me, 1985 will always be that year that I discovered pro wrestling to where I was conscious of it. You know, what was your experience?
Probably about the same year as you, 84, 85. I was really into the, I lived in Philadelphia, and the good thing about living in Philadelphia was you got all the wrestling was on. So everybody watched WWF, and I gravitated a lot toward the NWA. It was on at 2 o'clock Saturday afternoons. And it was like the best stuff. I was just so, so into it because it, and I look, WWF still had a lot of good things too, but the NWA just hooked me. I mean, they had the marketing right, where they have the big main event 1 minute before the show goes off the air. So you have to go buy the ticket to see the show that night, you know, and they were, you know, they had house shows at the Civic Center in Philly. They were some of the best shows I've ever seen. That was kind of my entry point, was NWA, WWF at the same time, but gravitated more toward NWA. I remember specifically watching, it was Jimmy Valiant and Paul Jones and the Barbarian and the Warlord, and they turned on Valiant, and they already had turned on him, I guess, or whatever, but they beat him to a pulp, and they put a big red X across the screen. And that to me was like, oh my God, I was at my grandfather's house. I was like, why is there a red X across the screen? Yeah. Like, I have to see this. And that kind of like hooked me in. It was that kind of stuff. And this, just the way the characters, the guys were cool. And, you know, it was so much fun. And then when I got to see it live for the first time, it was, you know, I'd seen WWF quite a lot at the Spectrum.
Right.
I remember my first NWA show, like it was yesterday. You know, it was Ric Flair, Ronnie Garvin, did 45, 50 minutes. You know, Arn Anderson and Dusty in the cage. The Russians against the Rock and Roll Express, Tully against Ron Bass, Magnum and Nikita. And it was just awesome. It was just so awesome. Because those shows, I compare it to what ECW became, because our house shows arguably were better than some of our pay-per-views and some of our TV tapings. So, but my entry point to answer your question was NWA in 84, 85.
I like the fact that you'll go off, you know, on Little John's, because it will also throw stuff into my mind. You know, about house shows in general, and the fact that we might not be seeing house shows, possibly, you know, ever again. Did you guys get a chance in those house shows to do what is one of my favorite things in all of entertainment, and that is improvisation? Did you guys just...
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, was it something where you would be able to get away with, you know, stuff that was either trying to, you know, work to see what would work onto TV, but more so even B, that is just the inside shit that goes on between the guys. Yeah. What was it like for you, man?
We had a lot of fun on house shows. I mean, we kind of did everything you just said. We improvised a lot, but I think what was funny about ECW is that we improvised all the time. Even, you know, when it was a TV tape and there was a pay-per-view, you know, there's always parts of the match, you know, you have to get to. It's just how you get to that part. And a lot of that was called on the spot. You know, as the Dudleys were getting more over and over, and, you know, we had the big thing with Dreamer and Spike and New Jack and Sandman, and there's so many people involved in that. Like, we just knew each other, and they kind of just You know, we knew the points we had to get to.
Right.
We knew when I had to get involved. We knew when Beulah had to get involved. Like, we knew those specific points, but getting to those points was kind of just going on the fly. And we tried, you know, I remember trying a lot more on house shows as Louis Dangerously versus Sign Guy, because Louis was more of like a standalone, what was a standalone.
Right.
And I was doing things on house shows before that had gotten on TV just to see if it was going to work. Because now I'm trying to get heat on my own and trying to do things on my own. And so they would put me out there with like various guys just to see.
Right.
Sign Guy was the complete opposite. I was already like, the guys were already part of it. I was made part of it. And we kind of just went. So there was not like a lot of trial there. Fun fact, though, a lot of the things that you see were tried at the what was, I guess, known as the House of Hardcore, is the ECW Wrestling School.
Right.
You know, yeah. That's the first time 3D was ever brought out. You know, I was there when it happened. You know, it was like a lot of things were tried there because we weren't running, you know, house shows a lot at the time. We couldn't try everything.
Right.
And so if you're doing a show at the ECW Arena and you want to do 3D for the first time, or when Bubba did his Bubba Cutter for the first time, it's like, you had no place to try that out. So they tried out in Long Island, and yeah. I think we had more matches there than anywhere. we also had a lot of fun, though. I mean, on the house shows, I mean, we goofed off a little bit. We took it dead serious, but we'd rib each other outside. We'd have fun. You know, it's like, you know, you're going hard, and it's like the locker room was so tight, you know, so we'd screw off a little. I tried to rib Sandman like all the time, but it was a lot of fun. But the school is stuff of legend.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of the House of Hardcore, you know, when you got trained, you got a little training from Tommy and Taz. When you first start, you know, kind of getting the idea of, I would assume that getting that, understanding the ins and outs, the psychology of the management of your role. You probably had, you know, just wrestling in general or watching movies and stuff probably gives you a little bit of that background. But what was it like for you when physicality had to come into play? Were you a physical person? Did you play any sports? Did you do anything? Or was it just like, fuck it?
Yeah. No, I actually played hockey and lacrosse. Okay. And so, I mean, I was used to getting banged around. This is a little different, though, because you know it's coming. And, you know, mentally that can mess with you. I kind of just went for it, though. It was just like, you know, the first time, you know, as the story goes, which is a true story, the first time I was ever in the ring was, you know, I was outside of the ring as a plant holding a Sign Guy sign. And there was a match between Dudley and Tommy Dreamer. And after the match, unscripted or not called, and not to my knowledge, Dreamer rolled out of the ring, got in my face, pulled me over the guardrail, and I'm like, what is happening right now? Like, this is not work. This is a shoot. This is happening. And you know, he throws me in the ring and he just says, watch the chair. I'm like, what? Watch the what? And I just figure I'm getting hit with a chair. So you watch the video, it's like, I just went with it. I put my head up, I got hit, he picked me up, he said, watch the DDT, gives me a DDT. And he gets to the back, he goes, where'd you learn to take a DDT at? Because I never learned it. I just kind of, you watch these things so much, and by no means can you pick it up on just watching, but you kind of just know. And Tommy and I were friends kind of before that fact, so I trusted him completely that he wasn't going to break my neck or, you know, split my head open. And then after that, it was kind of like, you know, Tommy kept an eye on me, and he saw me like I was getting bumped around a little bit more, and I had no idea like how to protect myself. So he asked me to come to the wrestling school. He said, let me at least show you how to you know, fall and how to do these things that a manager is going to do that's involved in the matches.
Right.
And he did that. And I remember the first time I had to take total elimination, they called me on a Monday. The show was on a Saturday. They're like, can you come to the wrestling school tomorrow? We have to practice total elimination on you. I think I took it like 20 times the next day. Like, no lie. I'm confident that I took more total eliminations than anybody ever. And most of them weren't ever seen because it was in the wrestling school to make sure I could take it. And it would look good because the eliminators have to look good in that situation too. Yeah. And yeah, they annihilated me. It was pretty awesome. It was really cool. But yeah, I took the physicality fine. I just kind of went with it. I never said no. There's nothing I can remember ever saying no to. At the same time, those guys knew me and they knew I was not totally trained, but enough to, like, as long as they protected me and the spot was cool, then I would be fine. I think the only time I ever said no was way after ECW, and I was doing some spot shows with Billy Corgan, and somebody went to do some insane thing to me, and I was like, that's not happening. Like, I'm an executive of Cirque du Soleil. I'm not having this fucking thing happen to me right now. And it actually didn't make sense for the storyline more than anything, but yeah, that was it.
Well, I think you just, that ending part, you just brought up a very good fact, and that is making sense for the storyline. And sometimes, you know, when you're working, you know, outside of, you know, the major companies, it's interesting because, you know, guys come up with their idea because they want to get themselves over. And that's one of the things I admired about your work is the fact that, just like Bobby Heaton, for an example, you knew your job was not to get yourself over. You knew your job was to give the shine to the guys. And essentially, as a manager, you almost work at some point in the match, you become a plot point. Because, you know, whether it be that pull of a leg or that throw in of a chair or a cane or something like that, you know, or that enough distraction when you get hit and you take the bump that when the face turns around, heel takes it over. So did you find that as something that when, would you add it to the match? Would you suggest, hey, this would be a point? Or did, you know, some of the, like, Bubba or Devon, when they're laying out a match, say, hey, we want you to do X during this point. Was it someone coming to you, or was you coming to them?
Most of the time with the Dudleys, it was them coming to me, because, I mean, first it was a respect factor. I mean, those guys were working hard. I always viewed it as, and I learned this very early on, like, I would see people trying to insert themselves, and not, it was not received well because of just what you said, because they're inserting themselves just to get over. Or be involved. And there's plenty of matches I wasn't involved in that I was just outside the ring getting heat and went to the back. It's fine. You know, I never, very rarely did I insert myself in a match in ECW, because one, the guys looked out for me and they knew, like, we want heat, he can get it, or he can do something. The only times I would come up with suggestions more so for the match itself, or, and that was rare, but, you know, I had some ideas here and there, and ECW was so collaborative that we had that space. But I can't sit here and think of when I would say, put me through a table or something like that. But I mean, I'm sure there was a time maybe on a house show, but it wasn't frequent. After the Dudleys left and Louis Dangerously was involved, I had a lot more say in what I was doing. So I'd make a lot more suggestions, because that was a character that, you know, obviously was building heat, and, you know, the payoff was Paul to hit me. So it was like, you're trying to finagle that a little bit. And then when I was talking about the Billy stuff, you know, the payoff, which never happened, but, you know, I was going to Chicago and Billy and I were doing our thing, and, like, the whole thing was, he was going to, like, blast me. I don't know what we were going to, probably know, like, the last guitar shot heard around the world or something, because I didn't have any more of those in me except for him. And I remember one night we were there and, you know, somebody wanted to do a spot, and, like, and I was like, no, the whole, like, I explained it to him why I wouldn't do it. I said, if you really want to dive on me, like, fine, but I'm not going to do anything. You know, the heat's going this way and the bigger pop would be that, and you're trying to explain it, you know?
Right.
But so, yeah, I got more involved after ECW and things I was part of. As far as even storylines, I worked for Carino, had a PWF, which was out of outside Philadelphia, that he started right after ECW, and you would see CM Punk had just broken the business. It was guys like that. So we did, I did a lot of the storylines and things for that. And that was fun learning that side of the business, but all that was post ECW.
Right. You just said Carino. What is it for you to be around, you know, that family sense? And then to see, like, a guy like Steve Carino, all of a sudden Allison Danger, you know, it's like, it's literally family now.
I was there for that too. I was there when she walked in the ring for the first time and she got it in her blood. I think, I want to say it was in Reading, Pennsylvania. We were doing a show at a stadium, a baseball stadium. I think it was a weekend of a pay-per-view for ECW. So we had Friday and Saturday off, and somebody booked us on Friday in Philly. And I think she walked the Sandman to the ring that night. And from there, it all went crazy. But she did really good, man. She did awesome.
Yeah, and she, you know, she's built herself up to, you know, someone that's very well respected. And I think that's one of the coolest things about ECW is that if you look at the lineage, it's comparative to the coaching trees in the NFL. You know, everyone always likes to talk about, oh yeah, these guys from Belichick went this way and et cetera, et cetera.
After
ECW closed, did you think that you would be staying in wrestling, or was it just that there were opportunities that came your way because of the fact that there was such a family tree there?
Yeah, I knew that my performing side was probably going to be done. After ECW went out of business, I mean, look, for about a year after it went out of business, we made a lot of money doing independent wrestling because everybody was pulling ECW guys. Everyone was trying to do, I forget, there was one company that started up that was basically ECW, just without all the guys who went to WWE. And I forget what the name of it was, but like, I got to do those shows, and now you're actually getting paid a lot because, you know, it's hot and there's no product. But the thing that I did in ECW was I learned the business side. I learned how to be a promoter. I learned how to be a marketing guy and public relations and all that. And I did that the last two or three years I was there. It was actually right after Bubba left, because Bubba had been doing that.
Right.
So then I start doing it. And that's where, like, I had a life after wrestling, because then at the same time I was working in ECW, it's also working for a radio station in Philadelphia doing their promotions. So between being a promoter for ECW, doing radio promo, I was setting up another part of my career, which is what I wanted to do. So I was in college. I did the same thing. I was a marketing guy, promoted concerts, all these things. So now I'm learning in the sports side. So I figured when ECW went out of business, like, I was upset about it, but I knew career wise, I'd probably be okay. And I think it was, I don't know, 6 months later, maybe. Yeah. About 6 or 7 months later, I started a job for Comcast, you know, working for the Flyers. So it got there, but that was kind of the end of wrestling for a while. I mean, I tried to hang on to it, but, you know, I would do the Carino shows because they were 15 minutes from my house. But, you know, when you're a professional, you can't really be getting concussions on the weekends and stuff like that. So I tried really hard, though. But I kind of knew, like, as to your point, like, the mail manager was done. And, you know, they call you for indie shows and they want you to drive, you know, 8 or 9 hours for $100. I was like, yeah, I'm good. You know, so.
You know, you brought up the old NWA / WCW. And you, of course, have a relationship with Corrigan. When you saw what he was doing in the recent NWA product and kind of getting it that feel of that old NWA, you know, vibe, where you had the interviews right by, you know, close to the ring and just that nice little setup. Was that something that when you first met Billy and you started talking to him and got to know him a little bit, that he showed that same love of what we remember as that TBS NWA five after the hour start?
Yeah, no, he's 605. He's the biggest, most passionate wrestling guy. One of the most passionate guys I've ever met. Surely coming in as a fan the way he did, he had a huge, huge passion for the business. And yes, I mean, him and I, as we became closer and became friends and start talking more and more about, like, you know, maybe doing his own thing or doing the, like, he did the Resistance Pro thing and stuff like that. There was always the drive of, like, old school wrestling, like, interviews and talking were his big thing, you know, and that's that translates into the product that he's working on now and things he was doing in the past. You know, he was such a fan. Like, I remember the first time I met him was in, I think it was 99 or right after the Dudleys had left, and we had a pay-per-view at the Odeum in Chicago. I wasn't on the show, but they had flown me there because now I'm doing the promoter work and stuff like that. So I'm doing that and I'm sitting in the back and someone's like, hey, the lead singer of the Smashing Pumpkins is here. If anybody wants to go say hi. And everyone was like, huh? And I'm like out the door, like running. Cause I'm a huge grunge guy, huge, you know, Pumpkins guy, and not that they're grunge, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just a huge music guy. And he knew who I was, which that messed me up completely. He's like, you're Sign Guy Dudley, before I even could get like a word out. And I'm sitting there having this conversation with this guy who I had just seen in concert. And like, when I graduated college, the first thing I wanted to do was go see the Pumpkins, which I did. Now I'm just like, the whole world is spinning around me at this moment. And But he was just such a diehard fan. He even said, he goes, what are you going to do now that the Dudleys are gone? I'm like, what? But we became, you know, we're still close. We talk every week, you know, but he has such a good mind for the business. Yeah. And I honestly will say this, and I don't know how he'll feel about this, but it's with love. The best things from him as far as wrestling, I don't think have happened yet. I think he's created platforms. I think TNA was a platform. I think the NWA is a platform that has, now COVID's kind of shut it down, but yeah. You know, not shut it down, but it's definitely changed it. I still think he's going to do something that's huge, that's even bigger than what he's done to date. I mean, he has a good reputation. He's a creative guy. He's a respectful guy toward the wrestlers. And that stuff goes a long way. And he surrounds himself with good people. You know what I mean? And it's, yeah. You know, I'm curious to see what happens next for sure.
Since we're talking about the Pumpkins, and you got the NIN sweater on, yeah. Man, what was it? Because I'm the same way, man. I find myself even more now, just loading my phone with all of the music from, you know, about 1988, 89 until, yep. You know, 97, 98. For you, what were the groups during that time period, and working, you know, in college, doing radio stuff, learning that kind of stuff? Did you have any other encounters with any bands?
Before wrestling or during wrestling?
Before wrestling, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, before wrestling, I was pretty lucky. I started the metal era in the 80s. So I was, you know, it was Guns N' Roses, Motley Crue, Metallica, and I'm still a huge GNR fans of everybody I just said. But
yeah.
When I got into college, I started writing for the school paper. I was a DJ on the college radio show, and college radio in those days was everything for bands, you know, and that's where, so I interviewed like Radiohead before they were like anything, like nobody knew who these guys were. Green Day, Rage Against the Machine, Blind Melon, like all these bands. Wow. And I would call the labels and be like, can I do an article on these guys? And they'd be like, yeah, sure. And you'd go to these shows. And I remember the Radiohead story I just told is really interesting was, you know, I got to interview the guitar player, Ed O'Brien. And I went to, I think it was Lowell Mass. It was UMass, one of the other campuses. And so he meets me and it's just him and me. And it's like, you know, whatever. They go play this show in front of like 300 people. He comes out after the show and he's like, what'd you think? Did we sound okay? And I'm like, yeah, this was sick. And now it's like, you're talking to radio, like Radiohead, right? And now it's like, okay. Or like Tom Morello, Rage Against the Machine, the same story. Like, can I interview these guys? And they're like, yeah, Zach doesn't do interviews, but Tom will go on Rage Against the Machine's bus. They're all sitting there. You talk to Tom, you shoot the shit, you leave. And like years later, you're like, it's Rage Against the Machine. You know, it was such a cool era. And to be part of it in that time was like, again, I was just the right time, right spot. And I was super aggressive in trying to get interviews too. Like I always thought like the school paper, you know, so you're playing the music, but also being able to interview the guys.
Yeah.
Like no one was doing that or pushing for that. And I just went crazy. Like I was pushing, I'd interview any band. And just some of the ones I picked were like really good bands that like,
sure.
You know, when you're talking about Rage and Radiohead, it was crazy. I never got to interview the Pumpkins, which would have been a crazy story the way life turned out. But yeah, my entry point for all that was, it was metal into like the Pumpkins and Nirvana and Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, Mudhoney, you know, and eventually obviously Nine Inch Nails. And when I was in high school, Nine Inch Nails came out and no one knew what the hell was going on. And I was like, this is pretty cool. You know what I mean? That's whatever it is. That was 1990, I think. So
Yeah, it was.
But I've always kept an affinity for music. It saved me a lot of times from just bad times in life or whatever. It's good inspiration and it fuels creativity. And you know, the bands that are playing, you know, now are still the bands that we grew up on,
right?
They're just as popular, so there's some longevity and consistency in the music too, so that says a lot.
Yeah. You know, absolutely.
When Nine Inch Nails first came out, Pretty Hate Machine, people were like, what the fuck? And I'm like, this is genius. And now look at it. So anyway,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
No, absolutely. I think that's, I mean, yeah. You know, it's interesting because of that fact, in almost any entertainment venue, when you hear the people going, what the fuck?
Yeah.
You know that something's about to happen. And that's the coolest thing.
Yeah. No, I don't. Go ahead. I didn't want to cut you off.
Oh, no. Go ahead. That's just my thought. You know, it's because anytime that I've been around, you know, a comedian or a band or, you know, anything that gets that kind of buzz of, you know, I don't know what the fuck's going on here. And then, you know, 3-6 months later, it's boom, it's just blowing up.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, to tie it back to music, and then I'm going to tie it into wrestling, is that, you know, in the case, since we were just talking about Nine Inch Nails, it's like, so the Cure's coming through the 80s, everyone's in, you know, their goth look and Robert Smith look and everything like that, and then suddenly Nine Inch Nails brings that to, like, a different kind of thing. The Cure's still massively cool, but now Nine Inch Nails is that branch going off here where it's just, like, same kind of crowd, same kind of lyrics, and it's just, like, bam. That's what happened with ECW, though, and that's the thing that I, you know, Paulie said it about a year ago, but I've been saying it since I got out of wrestling, is that we were Nirvana. You know, we were those bands, but in wrestling. Because if you, there's, I mean, and it's a hard point to argue, because if you're looking at what we did from, you know, 95 to 2001, I mean, that was the piece of work that was ECW.
Yeah.
And just like Nirvana had their piece of work, and, you know, Smashing Pumpkins still has their piece of work that's still going. You know, it was a brand, and the brand had a lot of credibility, because I believe bands are brands. You know, I don't look at a Smashing Pumpkins album and say that's the greatest album ever released. I look at their piece of work,
right?
What they've done from A to Z. And for wrestling, for ECW, a lot of people knock us and like, oh, the last 2 years, blah, 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 blah. It's like the piece of work was insane. Like what we did from point one to the end was nuts.
Well, but you know what? That's a, I'm so glad you said that, the last 2 years. And what I find fascinating about just fans in general, probably, but specifically wrestling fans, is you have a bunch of people who think they know the business, but have never been a part of the business in any way.
Yeah.
And so they can take something like that and not factor in the network, the advertisers, the shit that's going on, that, you know, here, someone like you, you're doing marketing, you're doing this, you're doing that. They don't understand the mechanics of the operation to make the brand what it is, and how it's the same thing with a band. Mm-hmm. How many bands have the most amazing first or second album, and then the record company fucks them because they want that same fucking album for the next 5 years?
Yeah. It's no diversity in that point. I mean, I just read an interview with Billy about somebody, you know, he has his new album Seer came out, and they're saying, you know, a review guy was a journalist was like, well, it's not Siamese Dream. Well, fuck, I'm glad it's not Siamese Dream. You want an evolution. You know, it's the same thing with wrestling. I mean, how many, you know, Raven and Dreamer is a great example. They tied that feud together for, I don't know how many years, but at some point the feud had to end, you know what I mean? And then the next chapter, even though they're all still intertwined somewhere, has to begin. I view music the same way. I mean, Siamese Dream is an amazing, amazing accomplishment. But the things that have happened after that is just another branch off from that that have kept it just as cool. ECW, you know, I don't put a lot of, you know, I don't know, faith or whatever into the what I hear about, like, what it was like the last 2 years. I mean, I was there. You know, I know what we were doing. You know, I saw it. I saw the crowd reactions. A lot of guys, we evolved, you know. When Carino was on top and you had Justin and Rhino and all those guys, Sandman and Dreamer, like, it was still good. It was amazing. Yeah. It just was, now is just different. And also the internet had taken more over, you know. I think what people have to remember too is in 95, 96, 97, it wasn't anything what it is now. So a lot of things we were doing was just kind of like, the only reason it lost its luster, I think, actually, because more people were aware of it. That even makes sense.
No, that makes absolutely sense. But that's, and that's what I'm saying too. When more people are aware of it, that's where I think the issue of the bigger companies wanting to make such a profit off of that. They come in, they sweep it up, and then they just basically lay the bones over there and take off with the carcass. And it's just like, I've had my experiences. I worked, I was working at Warner Brothers for a little bit. And, this was right around the time that, Warner Brothers, the WB network and, the Paramount networks were, you know, starting to merge.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was the same thing. The machine just kind of, you know, just all of a sudden just blended together because they saw the sensibility of, hey, we're just going to, you know, kill off that and then make more money off of this.
I get it. Trust me.
Speaking of, you know, some of those people that you mentioned and events, L.A., Heatwave.
Oh, yeah.
2000.
Was it Heatwave?
Oh, it was Heatwave. Yeah, I think yeah. It was the summer show. What were your memories of, cause I was there and, one of my first, in fact, I started my wrestling training at UPW, just a few months after that, I think maybe a month or two after that. And yeah. One of my first trainers was, So one of my first trainers was, an XPW guy. Do you remember, or did you have any involvement in that XPW, ECW?
Yeah. I did have involvement in it. Well, I mean, I'll tell you from my point of view. You know, I was backstage. I had a very, very small part in the show, and I was watching the monitor. And we had gotten. I mean, we knew they were there. I mean, they were in the front row, and. You know, when Lizzie took her shirt off or all that and tried to distract the pay-per-view, and then our guys kind of went to her. And I honestly forget the other guys that were there. I just know she, because I'm friends with her now. So it's just like, I don't, you know, I just know she was there. And I've actually always been cool with her. It's just, I didn't know her back then, but whatever. And her boyfriend do like this amazing clothing line. So I'll just throw a plug in there for her. Just look up Lizzie Borden. Anyway, so... They whatever happens, like, I guess somebody pushed Francine. I didn't see that part of it.
Right.
I just knew that when they got taken, when they went, their group of people got taken outside, a ruckus started, a very big fight. And I was very much involved in that. But, and Roadkill, it was, to this day, I thank him for, like, saved my ass big time.
Yeah, that's
because I was in a. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I thought I heard something where you were. In a bad, very bad position. Did you get hit?
No. What happened was I was trying to contain somebody. I just kind of had him down, and somebody was behind me with a chair,
a
steel chair. And it was not going to be a wrestling, you know, wrestling steel chairs hurt as it is.
Yeah.
Roadkill got there right before the guy hit me. So it would have been a blindside back of the head. Like it would have been really bad, but no, I didn't get hit.
Wow.
But Roadkill saved me on that one big time. It was a very small area. This was happening. And, you know, it was, I remember like it was yesterday. It was the arena, a street and a metal gate.
Yep.
And it all happened in there. And, so I remember like, cause I saw the guy fall and I turned around and Roadkill was there. And he's like, I don't forget what he said to me. Probably like, I saved your ass, you know, something like that. But yeah, no, he saved me. Man. He saved me big time.
No, that's.
But I didn't hit anybody. I just kind of like, I went out there like, what in the hell? I really didn't, you know, it was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. But I know I just had some guy on the ground trying to just contain the guy, but somebody else, I don't know who it was, but yeah, that was a fracas for sure.
It's, you know, it's funny too, because there are so many different, viewpoints and opinions and stories and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I just love, you know, trying to get everyone's memories, because I know a lot of people either from XPW, ECW, or guys that I know who have gone on to be wrestlers that were there, or fans who were there. And it seems like almost every single one of us has just a different recollection of everything happening, to where it just makes this one. It's like, that was a moment in time where you just go, man, that was something that you're never going to see that happen today nowadays. You know?
No. You know, that night was crazy. Cause you know, it was an early show. It was 5 o'clock because of obviously West Coast. And a bunch of us went to the Rainbow afterwards to eat. And I remember specifically Bubba calling me and being like, what in the fuck at your pay-per-view? Like, it was like all over the place, And I was just like, I mean, we were so numb to some of the things that we did. It was just like, yeah, we got into a fight in the streets. You know, what's the big deal? Like, we were numb to a lot of those things, especially after I ran with the Dudleys for so long, all the things I saw, I was just numb to it. I was just like, I don't know. These guys tried to disrupt our pay-per-view and we all got into a big fight. Now I'm trying to remember, was it Lizzie or Christy Mist who did that?
I think it was Lizzie. I think it was Lizzie. Because
I think I just read someone's report about it that said it was Christine. I was like, no, that's wrong. But anyway, sorry, ADD. But yeah.
But that's, you know, that's exactly what I'm saying. Like, everyone has this different recollection.
Yeah, no, I just read one that was brutal. And I almost wrote to the guy, but I was like, I'm not going to. It's so long ago. Who cares? But yeah. The recollection was just completely wrong and whatever.
Well, you know? And I think that's, you just nailed it on the head, too. It's like, no one holds any, you know, emotions anymore about it in terms of, you know, it being meaning anything, you know, anything other than this great, you know, it's the, it was the, I was at Roger Maris's 61st home run game type of thing, you know?
No, it's definitely a story. I mean, there's a couple of those in ECW, but the LA, as they call it, like the LA riot, it was not a riot, it was a fight. And there was just a lot of people involved.
You know, when you got a chance to work with Corrigan in Resistance Pro, what were your thoughts on what he was trying to do there? Did you see anything in terms of your marketing eye that you thought that this would be something that might be a viable company?
Yeah, I really did. I honestly thought it was going to do well. I thought because Billy, look, there's a certain level of credibility that comes with Billy putting his name on something.
Sure.
He brought me in relatively early after a couple shows. He had Raven there. It was like he was doing the booking with Nova. So you have guys, especially Scotty in that situation, who's like, you know, no BS. So it's, and that's what kind of got me interested. Because I was like, well, look who he's using. Like I said earlier, he surrounds himself with good people. So he had those guys there, and I thought, like, this could work. And he had a lot of good talent. You know, there was one, her name is Nikki St. John. She was, like, one of my favorite wrestlers to work with. In fact, I got to work with her, and I was like, it was, you know, I always call her out because she's one that I thought was going to go far.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened, but regardless of the fact, they had a lot of really good talent there. And yeah, I think it could have gone further. I'm not really sure what happened in the end. I kind of just ducked out of it because one, I got a concussion on the last show I worked. And then, so that was that, and that was just kind of like, that's the end of the physicality. But me and Billy had one more thing we were going to do, which I can't, I still have to do it with him, so I can't say it, but trust me, it's awesome. I just got to convince him, and I try to well, at least once a year. But we had some more things we were going to do. We had some cool things we were going to work out, and it just kind of went sideways. And then when I got my concussion, like I was supposed to be on the show a month later, and some like real life work things happened at Cirque, and I just kind of had to not, I couldn't focus on that anymore. Right. But to go back to your original question, yeah, I think there could have been some longevity there. But you know, politics get involved, things happen, and it's not, I don't even know if they run anymore, but you know, I think Billy puts his name on the right things. And I think that's why the NWA is such a good forum for him as well.
That's true. In 2007, you got the chance for the appearance on Saturday Night's Main Event. So, you know, what was your experience there and your involvement level? And what was it like, you know, working, you know, I mean, the wrestling guys are one thing, but Evander, man.
Yeah, that was crazy. This was simply a situation where I worked for WWE from 2006 to 2010.
Right.
In their marketing department. I was doing brand marketing, pay-per-view marketing. I did all the fan access stuff. And that particular night, I was at the Garden because I usually went to shows on the East Coast that were big shows so I could meet with the guys, you know, the talent and whatnot. I don't know who I was seeing that night, but I was there. I was there for a specific reason, to meet somebody and go over something that we were going to do from a marketing standpoint or a fan access standpoint. And literally, like, so, you know, whoever it was, let's just say, I don't know who it was, but whoever it was, I had the meeting and I usually hang out for most of the show and just kind of watch and stick around. So I'm just like walking down the hallway and Johnny Ace walks by. He's like, come here. And he's like, I'm like, okay. So I'm like, he brings me into a locker room and it's MVP. It's Evander. It's Matt Hardy. It's all these guys. And I'm like, why is Evander Holy? Like, what's going on? He's like, I need you to go to the ring with these guys as part of MVP's posse, just to make sure shit doesn't go south. I'm like, wait, what? You know, it's like, okay. And he grabbed me. He's like, yeah, you know, just make sure no one gets anyone's way. Make sure you stay on hard camera. Like, you know what you're doing. And then he walked out. And I was like, so I guess I'm here. And MVP didn't recognize me. Like, he didn't know I was Sign Guy Dudley right away. And it was right. hysterical because, you know, he was cool with everybody. He was being cool with everybody. But he was definitely like, I don't want to say hesitant, but he's walking out with a big posse of guys who've never been around the ring.
Right.
Who could get in each other's way and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, there's some probably a little hesitancy there. And then one of the guys, Joe, who is one of their publicists, goes, man, I get to go to the ring with MVP tonight and Sign Guy Dudley. And MVP turns around, and all of a sudden, everything was cool. Everything was okay at that moment because I looked a lot different, obviously. And we had a great, it was a lot of fun. The MVP and I became like kind of boys after that. I mean, I talked to him a couple of years ago, his last time, you know, just texting whatever. But yeah, but I understood the spot you're in. All of a sudden, you know, you're already in a big high profile situation with Matt Hardy and Evander Holyfield. And then you got to go to the ring with all these guys who've never been around the ring before. And some of them are writers or whatnot, but it's a different world there.
Oh yeah.
You know, but I did take a moment when I was walking down to the ring, I looked up and I was like, fucking Madison Square Garden. Just kept going. That was the cool part. But yeah, that's how that happened. That's how that happened. And I sold everything in the ring. Like I was Sign Guy Dudley. I was doing all the facials and whatever. I just was myself trying to get a job. That was
But
my tryout at the Garden.
What? First of all, how many people can say try out at the Garden in one sentence, yeah. which, yeah. you know, you can jokingly joke about, but that's amazing. You just kind of hit on something that I really am curious about, and that is sense memory of being in a ring and performing. Is that something that even, you know, today, let's say that you get the phone call and, you know, Billy wants to come down to United Wrestling Network just to do something really quick. Is that something that's yeah. like riding a bicycle for you? Because that's what I find as a yeah. performer. That's like comfortability, yeah.
yeah? Yeah, you know, for me, it's just like you have to know who you're working with, what their character's like, what they need. You know, with Resistance Pro, you know, Billy had a very specific thing he wanted to do, which I understood pretty quickly. And once you're ringside, a lot of it comes back. And, you know, you're still learning. It's funny because, you know, when I was doing the R-Pro stuff, this is way after, as you know, after wrestling or ECW, and I was at ringside with Raven and I was doing some things and Raven just kind of nudged me. He's like, he gave me some advice, like on the spot. And, you know, you're always still learning. He's just like, you don't need to be doing all these things right now because you don't need to, you know, make the things that you're doing, make them pay off better for the fans. This is at ringside.
Right.
You know what I mean? This is just like, I was like, okay. He goes, you know, it's cool. Just stand here for a second. And I just stood there and I was standing there. And he's like, see what I mean? Like, now do something, you know. So this is after the fact. You're always learning. So, yeah. And that's one thing that I think is cool about wrestling. But yeah, kind of it comes back to you pretty quickly as long as you know what you're doing and who you're with.
Yeah,
because yeah, it has to work with the person too.
Being out here now in Vegas, have you gotten a chance to you know, hang out with some of the guys, either if they come through town or like guys that live here, like Rob Van Dam, and you know, is it
yeah.
Is it?
No, not really. You know, some of the guys who come in town are usually, you know, when Dreamer's here, when Bubba's here, we always get dinner.
Yeah.
Same with Tommy. I saw Raven 3 or 4 years ago. He was here. We got a chance to catch up, and that was cool. Sasha Banks is my daughter's idol. So whenever she comes into town, she's been really cool to meet Emery backstage and do some things with her. Just to,
nice.
You know, and I think that's pretty awesome. So. She's one of them as well. They're just good people. So when good people come to town and I want to help them, they want to see a show or something like that, I think it's that's kind of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all I can think. I haven't seen Rob in a while. Last time I saw Rob was at Comic-Con, actually.
Okay.
And it wasn't yeah. even in Vegas. And I know he lives out here and Sabu lives out here.
Yeah.
I never see any of them. But it's not because I don't want to. We just don't. I don't know.
Yeah. Really quick, I'm going to kind of get towards a wrap here.
Okay.
How has this impacted you, the pandemic, in terms of, Cirque and, what's been going on with them as a company?
Yeah. So we haven't had shows since March, unfortunately. And, you know, it's shut down. I'm still employed. Very few of us are, so I consider myself really lucky.
Yeah.
I would say there's probably like about 10 people left in Las Vegas, I believe. So,
wow.
So all the artists are kind of just waiting and see. But it's up to the governor, you know. Yeah. It's up to, you know, they have the restrictions. I think it's now up to 50 people, and obviously we can't operate with 50 people. We need more like 700 or 800 people.
Yeah.
So we're following the government lead. We've done all our safety plans. You know, our vice president of operations is a very hands-on guy who's worked really hard to get everything, the protocols done with his team. So, you know, the teams that are left are artists, safety and PMed, so performance medicine and stuff like that. So when the artists come back, they've also been able to help put protocols in place for the audience and the artists for safety reasons as well. So we're ready to go. And we have a 55-page document that outlines our safety protocols. So it's just a matter of that coming back. But it's been really tough. I mean, I think the fact that we're sitting here in December, when in March we were like, oh, we'll be through this in a month or two. And then all of a sudden, it's just kind of all gone. You know, for me personally, it's been very hard. You know, I have a team of about 47 people, and it's three of us now. You know, and it's just like some of them got other jobs, some of them we had to let go. But, and that's just me. Yeah. You know, it's bigger than me. It's a lot bigger than me. You're talking about shows and technical support and the crews and everything that puts it together. I mean, you know, it's kind of heartbreaking. And it's not just Cirque; it's the entire city.
Yeah.
You know, everything's just like completely shut down. So it's been tough. It's been really tough for the city too, as well, you know, as a whole. So it's been brutal. I would say it's been pretty awful.
Well, I want to give you continued, success with that, because, you've had a great run with it and the shows are amazing, and hopefully, knock on wood, everything gets back up and running.
Yeah, for sure.
If fans want to follow you, where can they reach out to you and find you on social media?
So Instagram is LOU_DANGELI. And Twitter is LDANGELI. Maybe you can put these in below the link or something. And then Facebook is it's Lou D'Angeli / Sign Guy Dudley. That's the Sign Guy Dudley page. They won't let me just be Sign Guy Dudley. It has to be Lou D'Angeli, Sign Guy Dudley.
Fucking Facebook.
Yeah, and look, I interact with people all the time. I just recently got back on the Facebook page after about 2 years, and I was pretty blown away, actually, about all the comments and everything. It's, I think as I've gotten older, I start realizing the impact that I think we had on people.
Yeah.
You know, and it's something that, like I said earlier, we're in the moment in some of those situations, you have no idea. It's just kind of like it's just second nature.
Yeah.
You know, but now looking back on it, it's definitely, it's pretty humbling, so.
Awesome.
That's where I am.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate your time. Everybody listening, thank you for tuning in. Check out, all of Lou's social media. It's, it's a fun follow, and show him some love. And until next week, everyone, take care.
Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting.